This is Len Edgerly with the Kindle Chronicles, and I'd like to welcome you to this TKC Extra. It is the opening of an interview that I did on February 16th, 2012, with Peter Myers, author of the new Kindle Fire, The Missing Manual. You'll find the conclusion to the interview on episode 185 of the Kindle Chronicles.
You know, I really believe, and I was at TOC this week and Digital Book World 2 weeks ago. You know, these are big kind of publisher conferences here in New York.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of talk about DRM and piracy. And I kept hearing, and I certainly will join this side of the conversation, that the only company, the only entity in the world right now that DRM benefits is Amazon. And the argument goes like this, that the people who want to break DRM, the people who spend their time on Pirate Bay and places like that, they'll break any. There's no DRM yet, you know, designed,
right,
and probably ever will be designed, that is impervious to hacking. So the people who really want to pirate this stuff will be able to do it. The average consumer, it gets in their way of, you know, a sort of seamless reading experience, and it devalues the ebook, right? Because it makes you feel like, okay, I bought an ebook, but I can only use it on, you know, the Amazon device, or if I bought it at Barnes & Noble, I can only use it on the Nook, and so on. And what at the end of the day, I think what it has the effect of is, once consumers decide, okay, I'm going to buy a Kindle, it locks them into the Kindle platform, right? It locks them into the Amazon ecosystem. So that starts then deepening and strengthening the relationship between Amazon and the consumer, and makes the consumer feel like, okay, I just keep going to Amazon and Amazon and Amazon. And then Amazon now is in a position to beef up its role and its presence as a publisher.
Yeah.
Right. And now, in a way, I think there's a lot of interesting analogies to be considered in the music business. You remember, this is probably 5 years ago, where Steve Jobs came out with his big memo and said, hey, music companies, we don't like DRM. If you guys will get rid of it, we will happily, you know, come, you know, play along. And that's in fact what they did. And the music industry, I think, eliminated DRM in an attempt to, this is sort of an irony here, but in an attempt to see if they could loosen Apple's stranglehold on that industry. And I don't think that quite worked, because they did it too late. But I think right now DRM is mainly benefiting Amazon.
Because if there were no DRM, people could just move back and forth among the various stores, and
Absolutely.
There wouldn't be such a benefit to getting locked into the Amazon garden.
Or you could, you know, O'Reilly is a, you know, is a good example. You could buy files directly from publishers and put them on whichever device you own. Now, as you and I, you know, I think you probably played around on the O'Reilly site. Look, it's not like you need a rocket science degree or to be an engineer to set up an account on O'Reilly, download the file, get it onto your iPad. But it's a pain,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just hard enough that for a normal person, it's so much easier to go to Amazon.com, buy the book, or do it from their, you know, from their Kindle.
Yeah.
But if that stuff was if that was made a little bit easier, which you know could be made, you know, it really could happen. It could be made a little bit easier. Then, in a DRM-free world, imagine the changing landscape, and imagine the diminishing importance of Amazon, where, you know, Random House was selling their books DRM-free, and you bought one, and, you know, and you could move it between devices. Would people, you know, occasionally share, you know, would I send you a great book, or would mm-hmm. somebody, you know, of course. But, you know, the what's Tim O'Reilly's big famous saying about piracy? Obscurity is a greater, you know,
greater threat than piracy.
Than piracy. And I think it's true. I can't reel off the stats that I saw at Digital Book World off the top of my head, but somebody at Nielsen or Bowker or one of these firms that does a fair amount of market research and consumer attitudes studies did a survey, and, you know, they were looking at people who are really getting to be hardcore ebook buyers, and they're just buying so much.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing I saw at TOC was the people who go to libraries, because libraries are often brought up as an example of, you know, what piracy bodes, right? When you let people have free access to books, either in print or digital, you know, what does it do to their buying behavior? And the stat that I saw was that for every two books a reader checks out from a library, they buy one book. And the point there was, you know, libraries are a great discovery mechanism and a great discovery place. And this is something that publishers are all obsessed with, this question of, as more and more brick and mortar bookstores shut down, how will people find out about books? And so when they start talking about, should ebooks be available at libraries, this, you know, whoever was giving this presentation was making the argument, yes, they should, because it's not that people will stop buying books entirely, you know, if they have ebooks available at libraries that they can lend. They'll find out about stuff. What they do is they find out about new authors, they borrow a book, they love it, and then they buy the next two or three.
Yeah.
And here again, I think getting rid of DRM is another reason why it would help publishers, because the difference between if you stripped out DRM and you really let people own ebooks in a way that I don't think you can say they do today, you would then give people an incentive. You would make a clear line between borrowing a book from a library, which would expire, right, after 14 or 21 days, and the phenomenon of actually owning that book, right? And then you own the book, and it's part of your collection. And then you can imagine a kind of a scenario where other software developers come in, come up with great programs that let you visualize your collection, right? So we now have the what happens to the physical bookcase as we all move to ebooks. And, you know, so anyway, let me stop here and let's get started, because I feel like we've got a lot. Yeah, we should take advantage.
I might append this conversation to the end, because I think it's really fascinating. It's going to be fascinating to the listeners. I would think that since the press conference in New York City, there's few people who have spent as much time with the Kindle Fire as you have. And I can imagine all kinds of pros and cons of that experience. But I guess where I'd start is, what surprised you most once you get your hands on it and entered into the process of creating the missing manual? What was the biggest surprise?
Well, let me throw out a couple things. The size, you know, I've been a long time smartphone user, a iPad user. So I've gone back. I've been very used to the sort of 3 to 4 inch, you know, smartphone, the 9 to 10 inch tablet. But for the first time, being able to spend a significant amount of time with a 7 inch device was really wonderful. It was great, and I'll give you a very specific New York City reason. You know, where I live, there's obviously people are on the subway a lot and the buses, and 7 inches is great for one-handed reading, one-handed holding, right? Because you keep in, with an iPad, for example, you really need two hands on it. And if you're standing up and moving on a subway, on a bus, it's really not easy to hold it and swipe the screen. 7 inches is very different. You get it in your hand, and you can even, I mean, I don't have particularly large hands, but you can even curl one hand around just enough on the side of on the right edge of the screen to, you know, initiate a page forward, you know, a page turn. So that's really nice. Now there's another aspect to 7 inches, which is, how do you carry this stuff, and how easy is it to get out of your pocketbook or your coat? And I found in a couple jackets, and I didn't buy jackets, you know, designed for the Kindle Fire, but these are, you know, it was fall and winter as I was starting to get to know this, but so I had sort of normal, you know, fall and winter jackets. It would slip really nicely into my pocket, and I would pull it out, and I would immediately be playing with it, reading my book, you know, looking at the newspaper, maybe playing Fruit Ninja, whatever. And again, I compare that to the device that prior to the Kindle Fire I'd spent the most time with, which is the iPad, or as the tablet that I'd spent the most time with. And I often found myself even as quick as the iPad is to start up compared to, say, a regular laptop, I often found myself reluctant or hesitant to take it out when I had to get it out of, you know, my backpack. I would have to, like, well, I got to take my backpack off, zip open the zipper, and then pull it out and then open it up, right? I mean, it's only, we're only talking about a difference between from that to the Kindle Fire of pulling it out of my pocket,
yeah,
of what, 6-8 seconds? But in those moments during the day when you're trying to make those quick decisions about what device, or for that matter, what paper, you know, book or newspaper you're going to pull out, I think that's an interesting thing where they've really hit on something, where Amazon has really hit on a really important distinction. And I think that between them and the iPad, and I think that's been a big part of how they've designed this device. And I don't think it's fair to do an apples to apples comparison between the Fire and the iPad, but I think Amazon has actually done a great job of making it an apples to oranges comparison, right? Mm-hmm. They've done some very different things with this device that allows people who are considering getting a tablet to really have some very clear distinctions. And that's something you can't say, I don't think, about many of the other tablet competitors that have come out on the market since the iPad released. And I think that so many of those devices tried to be iPad knockoffs. And I think the great thing about the Kindle Fire is that it's a Kindle Fire. It's not an iPad knockoff.
You know, the quote that David Streitfeld, the New York Times, he seemed to get in a little hot water because he had, yeah, an article about the Fire that generated a torrent of reactions. And then it looked like he turned to you for support to say, hey, yeah, I'm not the only guy that's raising questions. And
yeah,
and he had this quote of yours that was sort of devastating, saying that your Kindle Fire was going to go back in the box as soon as you're done. The iPad, yeah, 2 is years ahead of it and lets me consume and create with no friction. Is that really where you ended up? I mean,
it is. And I mean, I'll be very honest here, and I, you know, I live and breathe and I'm surrounded by devices, so I use them for professional reasons, but also for personal reasons. But I will say, in the month or so since I've stopped writing, the Kindle Fire has not quite gone back into the box, and I'll talk about that in a sec, but it has not been, I have not used it, not in any significant way. I have mainly spent time with my iPad and my iPhone, and you know, part of that is that those two devices really fit perfectly well and satisfy all my needs and all my use cases. Not to mention my MacBook Pro, to finish out my credentials as a complete Apple, you know, Kool-Aid drinking. But they all occupy very different niches in my life. And certainly for the device that gets the most use is my MacBook Pro, because I sit at my desk and I do a lot of writing, and that's really the device for me. You know, the Kindle Fire, the place where, when I said it didn't quite go back into the box, it's because my wife has started to use it quite a bit. And for the record, she also has an iPhone, an iPad, and a MacBook, and then a Windows computer at work. So she is also somebody who's similarly surrounded by and gadgeted out. And I think one of the things that she's really loved about the Kindle Fire is the 7-inch screen, and particularly in bed at night she can have, you know, the Netflix app is great on the Kindle Fire, so we have a streaming Netflix subscription, and the size is nice. I mean, there had been a while where she was bringing the MacBook into bed to watch some videos, catch up on TV shows and things like that. And again, the 7-inch is nice because you can do things. This may sound small, but it's a sort of a user experience difference where you can more easily turn over on your side and just sort of gently rest the Fire on a pillow to prop it up, mm-hmm, than you can with a laptop. So she's definitely gotten more use out of it post the conclusion of my book writing than I have. You know, the other point that I think I touched on when I talked to David was about content creation. And I'm a big note taker. I do spend, as I said, a lot of time in front of my MacBook where I'm writing and coming up with ideas. But I'm also, I go out a lot for meetings, whatever, moving around the city. So I come up with ideas and I want to get those down. And I find that I use one app that I use quite a bit is called Evernote,
yep.
which is available on the Kindle Fire. It's a great app. It's yep. available everywhere. You know, it's a way to take notes and keep them all synchronized. And I find that for now, the text input on devices like the iPhone and the iPad is a little smoother than it is on the Kindle Fire. The Fire's keyboard, the virtual keyboard on screen, is definitely, you know, more than workable. It works, and the more time you spend with it, the easier it gets. And I can't quite categorize exactly or exactly precisely describe what the difference is, other than I just make more mistakes on the Fire, and I just find it easier to crank out text, particularly on the iPad. I don't love writing on my iPhone, so I guess maybe I don't think my hands are particularly big, but I think I need sort of a somewhat bigger screen.
Well, now, is there an e-ink device as part of the arsenal in addition to those other three Apple products?
There are one or two coming, I think, and I have not yet hit the buy button. But it's interesting. I have I'm on the verge of buying a new Kindle, and it will either be the Kindle Touch or maybe you can help me. What are they calling the $79?
Yeah, they just call it the Kindle.
Kindle.
Yeah.
Yeah. At some point they'll have to. Yeah. But so it'll either be the Kindle or the Kindle Touch. And the reason for that, in spite of all the devices I've just said that I own, is that I do find that one of the reasons I turn to books is for their immersive quality, is for the way that they help me forget about the world around me and lose myself in the story and spend, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 hours of great concentrated time in the presence of a storyteller, be it a novel or a great bit of history. And I find in all these devices that we've just been talking about, the Fire and the iPad and the iPhone, you're literally one button away from Twitter, Facebook, the web, checking email, and so on. And I'm looking for a device, and these, you know, the regular Kindles I think will do this, that has no other distractions. Even the absence of color, I don't necessarily view as a limitation, but actually as an advantage and an attraction. And I think it's interesting to consider and sort of have this discussion. Well, as the Fire continues to succeed, which by all measures it seems to be doing well, and I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that this is a huge part of Amazon's, you know, hardware lineup for the next decade and on, what will happen to the e-ink dedicated readers? Will they, you know, gently be retired? Will they be sort of kept around but not developed at all? Or will Amazon continue to think of them as fulfilling a particular niche in the lives of serious readers?